You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the summer 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's Alexandra Kleeman on books. An anti-heroine turns self-care on its head in Otessa Moshfegh's electrifying novel. The female body has long been an unruly subject, and a favorite one for women writers seeking to throw a wrench into society's machinery. In last year's Hunger, a memoir of my body, Roxane Gay calls hers wildly undisciplined. In Sick, out in June, Parakista Kakpur presents her relationship to her body as a lifelong battle. In Body Full of Stars, Female Rage and My Passage into Motherhood, Molly Caro May describes the painful awareness she feels toward her corporeal self during and after her pregnancy. At the heart of each is an inherent chasm between body and mind, between physical demands and societal rules. These memoirists find progenitors in the fiction of earlier writers, Charlotte Bronte, Anais Nin, Clarice Lispector, Charlotte Perkins Gilman. Take, for example, The Yellow Wallpaper, Gilman's 1892 short story about a wife bedridden at the orders of her husband, a doctor, who has decreed that what she needs to calm her nerves is a long period of confinement. So, she says, I take phosphates or phosphites, whichever it is, and am absolutely forbidden to work until I am well again. Gilman's narrator becomes obsessed with her bedroom wallpaper, ultimately disappearing into the patterning in an act of mad self-erasure. Or is it self-liberation? The Yellow Wallpaper seems to argue that if you only allow a woman to work, she will faithfully channel her dangerous imagination into healthful activity. If Gilman's story views idleness as imprisonment, Otessa Moshfegh's new book, My Year of Rest and Relaxation, published by Penguin Press, reframes it as a gonzo spiritual practice. The novel, a 21st century Unbildungsroman, is the account of a young, slender, privileged Columbia University graduate who chooses to squander her substantial head start in life in favor of a year of rigorously maintained sloth. Moshfegh, an acclaimed young novelist whose 2015 thriller, Eileen, was a finalist for the Man Booker Prize, is adept at crafting compelling female characters who violate the rules of femininity. This unnamed narrator is no exception. She's an anti-charismatic, agoraphobic, holy-go-lightly, a self-impersonator who has no fondness for her own performance. She drifts through passionless hookups with her Wall Street boyfriend, puts her art history degree to work, sitting behind the desk of a trendy contemporary art gallery, and participates reluctantly in her only substantial relationship with her college friend Riva, who visits her sometimes to drink wine and cry. After being fired from her job, she doubles down on her ghost-like existence and lives off the inheritance from her parents' deaths, swallowing a procession of Seroquels, Xanaxes, Ambiens, and more ominous pills that invoke ever longer swaths of unconsciousness. I thought life would be more tolerable if my brain were slower to condemn the world around me, she explains. What follows is a methodical act of existential self-immolation, as Moshfegh's narrator obliterates entire seasons in a fog of Downers, Diet Sprite, and Whoopi Goldberg movies. She gives away her closet full of Barneys and Bergdorf Goodman purchases, and leaves her apartment only to shuffle over to the closest bodega for coffee and cigarettes. But even this degree of freedom proves intolerable to her, and she begins to long for a deeper emptiness, which she finds by turning her life over to an artist who videotapes her as she sleeps and sleepwalks and cleans up around her so that no trace of her movements might be detected during her brief periods of lucidity. There was to be no narrative, no pieces for me to put together, Moshfegh writes. Even a shade of curiosity could sabotage my mission to clear my mind, purge my associations, refresh and renew the cells in my brain, my eyes, my nerves, my heart. It's a sly refusal of the imperative to self-care, the opposite of leaning in. As one fighting not to enter society, but to exit from it, Moshfegh's protagonist is an unlikely revolutionary. In the century-plus since the Yellow Wallpaper was published, as women have gained more control over their bodies and property and general happiness, they've actively been encouraged to work. To work at getting ahead, building a career, building a family, building good credit. To work at relationships, professional and personal. To work at 82 cents on the average man's dollar. And then also to work toward perfecting their pore size, their abs, their core, their back of arm fat. Being a woman has become a full-time job. We tend to think that a deeply ingrained system, such as capitalism, can be resisted only by equal and opposite action. But in a culture based upon striving, might it be more radical for women to opt out? Moshfegh's narrator's final gesture, transforming herself into a piece of half-living art, echoes the odd and combative passivity of Herman Melville's Bartleby, a scrivener who suddenly, inexplicably, refuses to perform his duties. Bartleby stands taciturn in the corner of his law office, offering no explanation for his refusal other than that he'd prefer not to. In a country that celebrates doers, such a preference is grotesque, an inversion of the American ideal of prospering through hard work. But it also serves as a reminder that there is something to life outside the economic exchange of time for money and money for goods, even if that unnamed thing is obscure and perplexing and just a bit monstrous, particularly in a woman. Literature may not have all the answers, but it can show us the power and allure of saying no.
Thank you.
Now this article on travel from Brent Hennemuth. Hipster luminaries turn a Berkshire's motel into a chic clubhouse. Photographs by Tria Jovan. Opening photos, a canopy room at tourist. Details in a ramble room, the exterior of the reclaimed Motor Inn. The derelict motel, the roofless barn, the overgrown picnic area. We've all driven past such sights and felt a twinge of lamentation, a sigh for when these places represented life, livelihoods, hope, beginnings. The five-person brain trust behind Tourist, opening this summer in North Adams, Massachusetts, has reimagined this lament as a call to action. What if we reanimated not only a little roadside hostelry, but also the greater community of which it is a part? On the westbound side of Route 2, the old Mohawk Trail, there stood for many years a faded sign bearing the word Tourist, a remnant of the adjacent 1813 farmhouse's past life as a rooming house. The sign, which has just been restored, provided inspiration. We wanted to reclaim the word tourist from the pejorative image of the tacky guy in the Hawaiian shirt, says Eric Kearns, the group's project manager. Kearns and his partners, the developer Ben Svensson, Brooklyn Magazine founder Scott Stedman, the chef Courtney Burns, and the musician and Wilco bassist John Stierrett, have purchased the farmhouse and a small Motor Inn up the road, as well as 55 acres of property along the north and south banks of the Hoosick River, in a subsection of North Adams known as Blackington. In a sense, the Tourist partners are reclaiming even the very idea of reclamation. Stedman notes that their endeavor is not another mannerist exercise in retrofitting a roadside motor lodge into a groovy shrine to space-age modernism. The motel, reconfigured and expanded to include 48 rooms, is elegantly contextual, its road-facing side cladded in vertical slats of plain white oak that block out the modern world, while its interior side opens onto pretty views of mature floodplain forest. In a clearing stands a chime chapel, a huge playable sculpture that Stierrett enticed his friends in the artist collective New Orleans Airlift to build. A 220-foot-long suspension footbridge leads to the Hoosick's north bank, and to Old Blackington, whose red brick mill once supplied woolen fabric for the Union Army's uniforms. A deconsecrated church near the mill will become the home this winter of Loom, a fine dining restaurant overseen by Burns, the group's ringer. A James Beard Award winner, late of San Francisco's celebrated bar Tartine, who has gone all in, upping stakes, moving east, and beginning the slow, laborious process of putting up an old-style New England larder of fermented and preserved goods. It's as if Judy Rogers, at the height of her Zuni Cafe acclaim, had forsaken the Bay Area for, say, Danbury. For Burns, the opportunity to be a partner in and witness to this experiment in regional reinvention was too much to pass up. I knew that if I didn't do this, she says, I would kick myself. As for the original roadside farmhouse, it will function as a social gathering place for guests, with an inviting parlor room anchored by an old Sommer & Company upright piano, a touristy spot in the best sense. Hollywood, Zen, and Now by Britt Hennemuth. In the photos, courtyard seating at Chateau Aner and restaurateur Reka Alexander. For Reka Alexander, running a restaurant is not unlike playing a jazz riff. As a classically trained pianist from Tokyo who studied jazz in England, it's the improvisation that connects the dots for me, Alexander says. You have to be nimble, and that's what it's like at a restaurant. The performance creates an experience for guests. EN Japanese Brasserie, her hotspot in Manhattan's West Village, recently celebrated its 13th anniversary, and now her bi-coastal clientele have something more to toast. Chateau Aner has just opened in Los Angeles. For Alexander, this verse started softly, a call from hotelier André Balas, before finding the key, an abandoned cottage nestled behind Balas Chateau Marmont Hotel on the Sunset Strip. Next, the tempo, Chef Abe Hiroki's kaseki menu, think more fried chicken than sushi, polished off with a melody that Alexander hopes the neighborhood will want to hear again and again. I want to build a family of guests in Los Angeles. Inside Aner, which roughly translates to set apart, roaring fireplaces meet tatami dining rooms, while the sunny courtyard is shaded by an imported pear tree. It's discreet and feels like a home, says Alexander. While traditional Hollywood dining has traded in paparazzi currency, Chateau Aner is a welcome sanctuary of food and design, entering L.A. at the height of the city's cultural renaissance. In the 90s, people wanted to be in London. 2000, people wanted to be in New York, Alexander reflects. Since 2010, people want to be in L.A. So far, I think it's pretty correct.
Thank you.
Style Goals by Isabel Ashton. With vacation season upon us, the Louis Vuitton 2018 FIFA World Cup official licensed product collection has us itching to pack a bag. The fashion house has teamed up with the tournament once again to reimagine its keepall in the classic soccer ball pattern. Fans can personalize their bag to match the national colors of their team and complete the look with a flag-embossed luggage tag. The line is available when the competition kicks off on June 14th, so consider your jet-set summer style sorted. Moving on to the fairground, H.W. Vail writes, creative power players step out on both coasts. In the photos, Art Production Fund's Kathleen Lynch, art consultant Nazi Nazand, and artist Sherry Leffler at the Village Fete in Brooklyn. The sunny side. Warm weather on the East Coast allowed the glitterati to break out the florals and wallets to support three worthy causes. Planned Parenthood of New York City's annual gala honored Laverne Cox and outgoing President Cecile Richards, who bid farewell after more than a decade at the helm. In Midtown Manhattan, the Paris Review threw its spring revel, toasting author Jay Williams with the Haddada Award for Lifetime Achievement. Rather, that's Joy Williams with the Haddada Award for Lifetime Achievement, while an exuberant David Sedaris accepted the Terry Southern Prize for Humor, telling Vanity Fair, "I never win anything." In Brooklyn, Dustin Yellen hosted the 5th Annual Village Fete, an Earth Day soiree to benefit Pioneer Works, his temple to the arts and sciences. On the West Coast, creative forces converged in San Francisco to celebrate the launch of the Santos de Cartier watch. Sofia Coppola hosted a wine tasting and lunch, which was followed by an intimate concert featuring French indie rock group Phoenix. And Beyoncé lit up the nation via Palm Springs with her performance at Coachella, where Kendrick Lamar, SZA, and Ariana Grande also performed. In the photos, Cartier tour and launch, San Francisco, Nas, Winnie Harlow, and Idris Elba, Lynn Yeager, Sofia Coppola, and Arnaud Carrez, Liev Schreiber, Chloe Sevigny. Planned Parenthood Gala, New York City, Audrey Gelman, Sarah Jessica Parker, and Cecile Richards, Questlove, Jessica Williams, Antoine Sargent, Kehinde Wiley, and Jia Jia Fee. Paris Review Spring Revel, New York, Sarah Plimpton and Akash Shah, Joy Williams, John Waters, Morgan Antrican, Patricia Marks, and David Gates, Patricia Marks, David Sedaris, and Isabella Hamad. And in photos from Coachella Palm Springs, Beyoncé, Ariana Grande. Fans cheer on Beyoncé, who made history as the first black woman to headline Coachella. Thousands flocked to the Music and Arts Festival in the California desert. SZA, Kendrick Lamar. Murder, so wrote O.J. Versace. That narrow bridge at Chappaquiddick, screens, have become a rehash vehicle for the seamy folklore of tabloid scandal, true crime, and national trauma, by James Walcott. Photo illustration by Sean McCabe. Gory lore, showing a montage with O.J. Simpson, Richard Hickok and Perry Smith, Tanya Harding, Jeffrey Dahmer, David Koresh, Biggie Smalls and Tupac Shakur, Charles Manson, Andrew Cunanan, Mary Jo Kopechne, and Edward Kennedy. The fine art of murder has entered its gilded age. Such lavishment of resources. The true crime genre may no longer throw the long tombstone shadow it once did in nonfiction publishing, but print's loss has been pixel's gain. Film, television, and streaming networks are reopening famous cases, redrawing chalk outlines, and hanging the toe tags at peak production capacity, making it hard for even the most devoted forensics freak or legal beagle to keep up with this golden oldies medley of major homicides and courtroom theatrics. Round and round the corpses go as the carousel continues to spin. O.J. Simpson's murder trial, the miscarriage of justice that keeps on giving, was the subject of two event miniseries in 2016. Real-life prosecutor Marcia Clark even scored her own show on A&E, Marcia Clark Investigates the First 48. The brazen rubouts of rap artist Biggie Smalls and Tupac Shakur formed the double-barreled focus of the 10-part Unsolved, The Murders of Tupac and the Notorious B.I.G., USA Network. David Fincher, whose Zodiac is one of the top five aesthetic wonders of the true crime genre, delved deeper into the devious maze of the serial killer psyche with Mindhunter, Netflix, based on John Douglas and Mark Olshaker's book, Mindhunter, Inside the FBI's Elite Serial Crime Unit. Netflix has a heap of other docs and docudramas sitting in its factory showroom, including The Keepers and Wild Wild Country, and a hangar packed with white-powdered, sweaty informant cartel sagas, Drugs Incorporated, Dope, Narcos, Cocaine, etc. The much-trod legend of all-around monster Jeffrey Dahmer was revived from a unique angle in My Friend Dahmer, based on the graphic novel by high school pal Durf Backdurf. The apocalyptic siege of the Branch Davidian compound, presided over by messianic nutjob David Koresh, was given the full Alamo treatment in the miniseries Waco, Paramount Network. Chappaquiddick, the assassination of Johnny Versace, the looming tower, the casualties just keep on coming. On the 50th anniversary of the Charles Manson murders, August 9th, 2019, to be gruesomely precise, we are due Quentin Tarantino's all-star deathmobile, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, a movie unlikely to air on the side of delicacy. Somebody mounting their moral high horse might cite this inundation as another sign of what sickies and sloths we are in the era of Netflix and chill, a nation of bloodshot eyeballs marinating in constant stimulation. Completely true, of course. No denying it. Guilty as charged. And yet, I would argue that we're no more slovenly or depraved than we ever were, despite the return of Roseanne. If anything, our appetite for mystery, sensation, and elusive closure has developed a more refined palate. Quantity usually drives down quality, but not here. The quality of this recent spate of true crimers is mostly unimpugnable. These movies and series aren't hack tales from the morgue, cynical schlock rehashes that load on the catch-up. Technical proficiency and narrative sophistication have never been tonier in the entertainment matrix. Everything beautifully machine-tooled, down to the subtlest dramatic beat. The soundtracks often deploy an ominous ambient industrial hum that we associate with classier suspense thrillers, as if orchestrated by the ghost in the machine, or unroll a low cloud of gravitas that augurs something fateful waiting around the bend. Chappaquiddick, measuredly directed by John Curran and solidified with a cast that never goes actory, tolled a requiem bell over the watery death of Mary Jo Kopechne and restored the tragic aspect to a story that in 1969 devolved into a welter of howling headlines. A cause célèbre, another sign of the Kennedy curse, a source of sick humor, and for decades after, a right-wing talking point. It was a trauma for those directly involved, but not a national trauma, which requires a more complex array of cinematic resources or narrative blueprint. In the television era, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy was the coming-of-age moment for millions of baby boomers, and the day history went off the rails. Replaying the horror from a battery of different angles, eyewitness views, and trajectories, Oliver Stone's JFK, for all of its slanted conspiracy mongering, deconstructed those 6 seconds in Dallas, not simply as an unresolved case thronged with sketchy figures, but as a fresh wound, a collective PTSD that infected the culture with a justifiable case of paranoia, of which Don DeLillo is our prose poet emeritus. National traumas are tricky to deal with dramatically, because over the last 20 years or so, Americans have been so grief-counseled into not dwelling on the past, to move on with our lives, that recreating the trauma and all its screams, chaos, and carnage can be viewed as triggering, or, if the purpose of the project is to showcase heroism, trivializing. The Al-Qaeda assault of 9/11 and the collapse of the Twin Towers, prophesied in the film Fight Club and the TV series The Lone Gunman, was a magnum blow delivered on live television against the delusional pride and security of the U.S. that furnished the casus belli for the war on terror. Getting the new millennium off to a wretched start that even two sanity-prevailing terms of President Obama couldn't reverse. Contemplating Paul Greengrass's United 93, where passengers thwarted the flight's hijackers from presumably crashing the plane into the Capitol, and Oliver Stone's World Trade Center, a survival story about a pair of Port Authority police officers buried under rubble, Daniel Mendelsohn wrote in the New York Review of Books in 2006, however much they seek to illumine the events of September 11th, the films of Greengrass and Stone are, in the end, more like curtains than windows. For the present, at least, we still can't bring ourselves to look. We still can't. Or won't. Not full on. As if conceding this to take a more incremental route, the Hulu miniseries The Looming Tower, based on Lawrence Wright's nonfiction Pulitzer Prize-winning bestseller, brocading the incidents, interrogations, unheeded warnings, and missed opportunities that led to 9/11, plays as a police procedural, an epic law and order, in which the bad guys foil the feds and survivors stagger from ground zero caked in dust. It's a skillful, well-produced, superbly cast retracement, an invaluable history lesson for a country that refuses to learn history, much less any of its lessons. Our leaders repeat the mistakes of the past with perfect virgin aplomb. The more flauntingly ambitious productions can stretch a pointillist canvas of period details so voluminously over 6 or 8 or 10 episodes that they lack the concentrated punch of a true crime classic, such as Fatal Vision, 1984, the two-part adaptation of Joe McGinnis's account of the trial of Dr. Jeffrey McDonald for the murder of his family, which McDonald blamed on Manson gangish hippies. Possessing the production values of a Columbo outing, Fatal Vision nevertheless lodged itself in pop culture on the strength of Gary Cole's star-making performance as McDonald, whose facade as the grieving father slips when he advises his attorney to have the character witnesses lay off all the talk about his dead daughter's Christmas pony. If they, the jury, hear about that pony one more time, they're gonna puke. The Investigation Discovery Channel's recent original telefilm, Final Vision, based on McGinnis's follow-up book to Fatal Vision, was far more guttingly graphic in its reenactment of the domestic slaughter. Similarly, the scene quality, the scenic quality, of a two-part network TV adaptation of Norman Mailer's maxi-minimalist masterpiece, The Executioner's Song, wouldn't remind anyone of Terrence Malick sanctifying the horizon, but it planted Tommy Lee Jones's glowering mug on everybody's map for his Emmy-winning rampage as killer Gary Gilmore. This more compact, emphatic approach can be truer to the original tabloid horror, but today's epic mode favors the long soak and over-engineered saturation effect. The assassination of Gianni Versace, based on Vanity Fair contributor Maureen Orth's Vulgar Favors, is the most extravagant entry to date in FX's American Crime Story franchise, Fellini, American Style. The first installment opens with the shooting of the mercurial fashion designer, played by Edgar Ramirez, at the gates of his Miami Beach estate by Andrew Cunanan, Darren Criss, a heat-seeking, fame-craving psychopath, the camera propelled as if adopting the POV in a first-person shooter video game. So stylized and iconized that it seems custom-made for replay on an endless art snuff loop, Versace's murder didn't carry the jolt of a life prematurely taken. It told the fulfillment of a reckoning preordained, the fatal final collision of a fashion emperor and an envious cast-off. Given the extravagance of Versace's kingly lifestyle, the miniseries couldn't be expected to practice tasteful frugality, but 9 episodes seems a lot of time, money, and scrutiny to expend on a punk whose sole claim to notoriety were the corpses he left behind, even if the series does posit him as the poster child for the dark side of the American dream. Next photo, sinking feeling. Jason Clarke and Kate Mara as Kennedy and Kopechne, shown here on the beach. Less heinous crimes have also received a fancy regurgitation, a kitschy satire staged like a commando raid, I, Tanya, starring Margot Robbie as skating badass Tanya Harding, and Allison Janney as her chain-smoking, abuse-barking momster, applied a cheesier, staccato, cartoonish mode of attack to rivet its message of lower-rung resentment and stymied upward mobility. Only director John Waters has managed to pull off camp comedy free of class condescension. What's striking about the true crime canon represented above is that it seems to belong exclusively to the previous century. That's where the lore is. The memes are O.J.'s white Bronco chase, the severed heads in Jeffrey Dahmer's fridge, Nancy Kerrigan wailing, why? More contemporary crimes and mysteries are being spread out on the examination table of Serial Podcast, an addictive medium, as the success of Dirty John and the Atlanta Monster demonstrate, but belonging to the aural realm, they can't hang the iconography that gets passed on from generation to generation. As in so much else, pop culture is raiding its capital reserves, just as network television is leaning hard on revivals and reboots. But this may be a temporary drawdown until the next Gushers. They're already here, but have yet to play out to completion, to provide future storyboarders with the necessary third act for their treatments. I speak of the hashtag MeToo movement and Trump's To Russia with Love romance, built on a bed of sex, lies, and P-tape. These will furnish all the lore we need to forge on. Ryan Murphy, television's tireless, multiple warhead writer, producer, showrunner, is already developing a hashtag MeToo project titled Consent. Picture the unsavory possibilities. Harvey Weinstein haunting hotel rooms in his bathrobe, like a Dybbuk, or the roaming hands of Charlie Rose in pursuit of vulnerable flesh. The Trump administration could easily supply several seasons of American Crime Story with plenty of leftovers for the DVD editions. The key will be content creators being shrewd enough to see that the forerunners for the Trump syndicate takedown aren't the Watergate conspirators, but the Gambino family. Don't think Richard Nixon, think John Gotti, and let the thuggery write itself.
Thank you.
on the Vanity Fair agenda, an event, Genesis at Hollywood's Biggest Week. Genesis once again partnered with Vanity Fair to celebrate Campaign Hollywood, Vanity Fair's yearly week-long series of events that has become synonymous with Oscar Week, honoring the year's best talent, artist, and stories. This year, in celebration of the success of 20th Century Fox and Fox Searchlight and their nominated films, Genesis and Vanity Fair hosted an exclusive toast event at Wolfgang Puck's Spago in Beverly Hills. Notable guests included Best Director winner Guillermo del Toro, Best Original Music Score winner Alexandre Desplat, Abby Cornish, Liz Hanna, Nicholas Holt, Doug Jones, and more. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.